This is the Roaring Elephant Podcast, and here I am with my favourite attack vector. It's Yon. Hello, Yon.
Favourite attack vector. Well, I guess I have a purpose now, which is always a good thing.
There we go, see?
I have a link and a direction. What more do you need?
I mean, nothing. Clearly nothing else is needed.
Okay, well, that was this for the podcast episode. We have all we needed. We can move on to something less interesting, like reading further down the Deborah report.
Indeed, indeed. We continue to, just share a couple of things that are interesting to us in this ginormous report. And why not dive right on in with the top attack vectors in breaches. Now, on the one hand, this isn't all that surprising, I guess, that web applications at 34% are the largest attack vector, and sadly, email at 27%. So I would differentiate these two. So like web applications, I'm guessing the majority of these cases are, this is people, breaching the web application in some way, shape, or form. Whereas email...
And phishing sites. Which is,
yeah. But where email is not something phishing. That someone must proactively trigger. There are very few email breaches where, just the mail client itself will execute things on your behalf. So,
it can indirectly. I mean, just think of an Excel file as an attachment that has a malicious macro.
But you've got to click on that sketchy Excel file from that weird email address that
I'm wondering if this also includes data breaches where somebody hacked the email server and got the logs, content, whatever. Same with web applications. A lot of passwords are in the open because small and large organizations got hacked and their data was dumped and wasn't encrypted. If I sign onto a web application and I use my information there for some reason and they get breached, is that also a web application? I'm just looking through, I don't see where else it would be.
Maybe.
You have the other, of course, in the third place, but let's not look at that one because that's way too vague.
Yeah. I mean, it's the slightly scary thing, at least to me, is that the sort of, you would normally hope that maybe, you would have one, two, or maybe even three things that were quite significant that maybe you could focus more on, and then the other things would be a lot less likely. But actually, there's a lot of things that hover between, 15 to 20%. As you say, like the other category is third at 25%. Carelessness is up at 21%. Other network services 19%. Direct install, which is as you mentioned before we hit record, people downloading that Photoshop crack or game hack or
just remember nothing is whatever. Free. If something is shown for as free tool, free whatever. Someone gets paid somewhere.
But Jan, they do it for the love.
Yes, the love of money.
Yeah, that's true. And then, desktop sharing software down at 13%. Desktop sharing software, beloved by scammers. If you ever are requested to install this desktop sharing tool, so this support team can help you fix your problem with Windows. It's almost certainly a scam.
This is fun. I used to get these. This is Microsoft calling you because your PC is malfunctioning, blah, blah, blah. And I got those when I was working at Microsoft. So I actually had some fun a couple of times, but in the end, it's just a waste of time, obviously. As much time as we waste on their end, that's time they can't spend hacking anybody else.
Indeed.
I actually think that desktop sharing software here is not the right name for it. It should just be malware. because there is desktop sharing software that works correctly, works pretty well, okay. I mean, if you look at a remote desktop from Windows, from Microsoft, there haven't been that many vulnerabilities in that software. I think they're really thinking here about exactly the call centers that call you up and have you install a piece of malware that thinks or presents itself as a desktop sharing software. So I'm kind of...
Yeah, I mean, they could also use legit desktop sharing software and then also, you know, do things behind the scene with it. But yeah, it's... I think they lump all of those things into the same category. But yeah, it's just, it's sort of, I mean, the only, wouldn't necessarily say it's good news, but like the lowest categories are sort of, you know, backdoors in things at 12%, which is good because like there shouldn't be backdoors in things.
Conflicted. Is 12% a lot or a little? On the one hand, you say, yeah, we don't want backdoors, so 12% is kind of high. On the other hand, I'm pretty sure there's backdoors everywhere into everything. I was a developer once. I know how this stuff works. I see the 12%, and I really can't give it a value judgment on if it is good or bad.
Yeah, I think it's bad. I think it is quite scary that the number is that big. But yeah, I know what you mean.
Because that's the backdoors being used in a breach. It's not all the backdoors available. Yeah. Right? There's just a subset of backdoors available, and people usually hide the backdoors pretty well. So if there's 12% abuse, there must be like 100 times more available in the wild somewhere.
Yeah, that maybe haven't been discovered, or maybe the breaches using those backdoors haven't yet been discovered. Like it's a scary thought that... You know, any sort of software legitimately that you could install could have a backdoor. I know the UK government, actually, it's crazy. The UK government have recently made two very positive decisions, which obviously means the apocalypse is about to happen or something like that. But like one was they rescinded their request that Apple install backdoors for... government services to be able to snoop on things, which I think is a very good thing. There should not be backdoors.
That wasn't exactly by choice, right? They kind of got painted into a corner and kind of couldn't do anything but this.
I'm very glad at it regardless.
My problem is that they can say that, but still demand it.
I mean, sure. Government be governmenting all over the world.
And probably they just decided that they don't need their own backdoor. They're just going to use the one the US already has installed.
Yeah, God, maybe. But the other thing actually is classic car ownership is going to get significantly easier. And the definitions of a classic car is also going to get significantly easier. Nothing to do with technology, but it's a great, great decision for all UK classic car owners.
I think it has some security because classic cars have no computers on board. Yeah, and again, the best way not to get hacked is not own anything that runs on a PC.
There you go. Don't worry about that pesky electronic fuel injection carburetors with needles and trumpets and all that good stuff. Yeah. That's what you want.
Good arm force swing turning thingy. That's all you need, basically.
Exactly.
Take the Flintstones mobile. That's basically pay. That's it.
Anyway, it's just one of those. This graph is. In part, sort of reassuring in that, maybe reassuring isn't quite the right way to put it, but
it's not unexpected.
It's not unexpected, but then they like go a little bit deeper, and there are some somewhat worrying details there. But anyway, yeah, that was my take on this one. What's next from you?
I don't know. Let's see. We're going to... This was, by the way, page 28 in the report. And now we're going to go to page 30 for a little chuckle. Because page 30 talks about CVEs. And I actually forgot what it stands for. It's an acronym, CVE. I always use CVE. I have no idea what it stands for anymore. It's security reports kind of thing, vulnerability reports. And this graph on page 30, figure 30, shows how long CVEs remain unremediated. So the question we already had was, okay, is it starting from the point that it was a problem or that it was reported? Because there can be a huge time between something bad being in the field and somebody writing a CV about it, because now they found it. Could have been 2 years of abuse before that, obviously. I think we kind of decided this is probably when the CVE got listed, got published. So it became something that now has to be remediated.
Well, not quite. So, so first of all, CVE, Common Vulnerabilities and Exposures. That's what it stands for.
Encyclopedia, that's why you're here.
And I did have to look it up because I could remember common and vulnerabilities, but I couldn't remember what the E standed for. So obviously CVEs, you file them, but initially they're private. So I'm guessing the clock in these cases, I'm guessing it's for the organization that the CVE is for, I'm guessing that the clock actually starts ticking when the organization first activates that CVE number for that particular issue, rather than the point where it goes published.
Because that would mean that I can just ignore it and nobody can report it as a problem. I think, yes, they're private. There's not private. They're just a select company only, and to give a company chance to repair it before it goes into the open. But I do think that it starts counting from the moment that that organization gets warned that, hey, there's something wrong, you have to do something.
Could be. Okay. Yeah, that's fair. Otherwise, in fact, you're right, because let's say days from initial notification by vulnerability scan. So there you go. It's not even when they get notified, but it's when a vulnerability scan notifies people. So if that's fine. So just don't ever run your vulnerability scan.
But anyway, the thing I want to talk about is how long it takes for these CVEs to be repaired. And dear listener, just have an exercise for yourself. What would you think is an acceptable time? Then think about what is likely the time that they take, which is going to be pretty much a multiple of what you thought was an acceptable time. And then think about what the graph is showing here. It has a couple of boundaries here, but if I look, most of them get solved within a month. I mean, that's good, I guess. And I say most, that's not most. That's kind of half, let's say, if I look at it. It's a weird graph to interpret that way, but I mean, a big bunch gets solved quickly. And obviously a lot of CVEs are just quick fix potential things. But then there's like a long tail that takes up to 155 days. That's about half a year. And then there's the end of that tail that lasts, the last label on the graph is 222 days. And that's not the end of it, because there's still some that trickle on past the 300, I think 360, if you look at the last little blue ball there. So I know that people often talked about dwell times of malware being in excess of a year. But even CVEs, I mean, dwell time for me is you got attacked and you didn't see it until a certain moment. But this is when you see it, right? It's been notified, it's there, and now you have to start doing things. And then it takes, on average, half a year, and with a bit of bad luck, more than a year. That is incredible. And I'm sure there's a couple of niche cases there about things that aren't fixable because it's a no longer maintained project or it's something like that. There will be some there, and let's hope that the blue balls at the end are those cases. But there's too many little green balls in the 155 to 222 range to be all attributable to that, I'm afraid.
I was gonna say, like, I think you're right. But you know, we on the previous set of episodes where we were talking about you know, people still using CentOS, for example. You know, there are, I'm sure there are CVEs there that are, you know, now that has been no longer supported for quite some time, you know, there are third parties patching those things. But, you know, if you've just got a CentOS Linux, you know, server out there and it's just subscribed to the default repos that are no longer receiving updates, you're going to have a whole bunch of CVEs that are against
them. Hang on. I think you're not, I think this is different. This is not the time it takes for the CVE vulnerability to be patched everywhere. This is for the CVE to be fixed, so for a patch to become available. The remediation of vulnerabilities. I mean, nobody can say there will always be a server somewhere that has an old version, so you would never be able to make that that graph. But you can make a graph saying that, okay, we reported vulnerability on January 1st. We told it to company Bloop Industries that there was a problem, and they fixed it 2 months later. That's the time. That's what this graph does. Because you can't make a graph. I mean, how would you know that there is no longer a single library on that has that vulnerability available anywhere?
So, I mean, they're using the... I don't know. I don't think that's the case. I think that's the case.
I'm pretty sure. Because remediation of a vulnerability means you fix your software. Okay,
yes,
this is, of course, a questionnaire sent to people that are using the thing. So
yeah,
you could say
exactly
how long it took you to install the patch.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, personally, I'm a pessimist, so I would like to say that my original idea is the correct one.
I don't think so. I think it is organizations and the CVs that they have they still have reporting within their organization. So I think there are two major categories. One is the one that you highlighted and I just echoed there, which is around, you know, stuff that is no longer maintained or, you know, whatever. But the other sort of category that, you know, I unfortunately do, you know, have heard about is CVEs that exist, but the risk profile of, you know, where that particular application or server or instance is such that, oh, it's an air-gapped environment, or it's somewhere behind multiple layers of other protection, therefore, you know the chances of it actually being breached this particular way are incredibly low. I'm not saying I agree with that approach, but because you only need, you know, attackers only need to get lucky once. You need to get lucky all the time as a defender. So, you know, those are the other examples I see when companies are aware that they have CVEs that are still open on environments that they manage, but they deem the risk of those CVEs to be low enough that they prioritize doing other things instead.
Yeah, I mean, the even worse part of that is that it's either that or they're too lazy to do it. Because what you're basically saying is that sometimes there's a reason, valid or not, let's leave it in between, that they don't apply them. I would say that's a minority. It shouldn't be a lot of them. So the alternative is that they could do it, they should do it, they just don't. For over a year sometimes. That is...
Yeah. I mean, you're a pessimist. I'm obviously very optimistic, and I think that everyone has the their altruistic, you know, best thoughts in mind. But yeah, I know it's tough.
You can't kill all the bugs because then they're gone. You have to keep them alive and feed them so that they don't get extinct.
I'm not sure that's.
I almost made Dave laugh there.
Almost. Yeah, it's a tough graph to see, that one. All right.
So shall we move on to the next one? Or
yeah,
we're looking at the end of the time here.
Well, I think we could do one more.
One more. Are we going? Oh yeah, it's a funny one. Let's go to page 32. Although it would be a good one to start the next one, but this is one that I kind of chuckled about, because on page 32 in the various assets, there's a figure 34 that says top asset varieties in breaches, which pretty much, I think, means what are the tools or things used to get the information to get the breach happening, or something like that. And the usual suspects are there again: web applications, mail, end user employees, desktop laptops, other is a very popular one always as well, and databases, remote access, documents, and then there is fax. Apparently, social engineering, phishing by fax is still a thing in 1.2% of all occurrences.
Who got done by a fax, eh? I mean, that's just sad.
I mean,
receive a fax message. Could you send me your password? Or a fax message, could you scan this QR code on your phone? Or it's just sad. I don't know how else to explain it. Like, I'd love to know what those breaches, like, I'd just love to know the story behind the breaches that happened through fax. Like, I'd love to know what sort of companies they are. I'd love to know, like, what actually happened. It's just so weird.
And it's also very bad, I think, because I would expect that the only faxes still alive today are in very serious locations. I mean, I've heard once, I have no idea if it's still true, that nuclear missile silos still have a fax machine because it's kind of the dumbest technology we have, so it should always keep working. They no longer use the Morse code thingies anymore. They have faxes these days. But, I mean, that's what I mean. Typically, these faxes are in these kind of very secure, high-impact locations. And if those are actually vectors for intrusions...
I mean, the other thing is there was a lot more kind of Asian input into this year's De Beer report, and faxes are still not as widely as they were maybe 5 or 10 years ago, but they are still used fairly commonly in countries like Japan, for example. So, you know, maybe there's an element of that. Mr. Tanaka-san requests your password via fax.
Fax of 20 pages with all 0101010111 with a little text in front. Please open the binary editor and type this into your computer. I mean, that's how we started with computing, right? With our old Commodores and Spectrums. You got these magazines with code and you just typed it over. You had no idea what it did. And you hoped that something pretty came out. Why not? If it works, it works. Yeah. I guess.
And I think that's a perfect place to leave it for today.
Yes, with that, we will not put this podcast on the iTunes as usual, just fax it to everybody. Just please send us your home address and credentials so we can send you this podcast episode by fax.
And your phone number, of course, or your fax number, sorry.
Fax number, obviously, yes. And that will actually help us more than your support by becoming a Patreon. But please do become patrons. Patrons do help us keep the roaring elephant roaring for almost 10 years now. We also have a website at www.roaringelephant.org. Information there, patron page, but the podcast itself. And you can also send email to us at podcast@roaringelephant.org. Send us feedback. Let us know if you like us still or if you should do something else. Until next time, my name is... it's all facts from me from now on, Jon.
My name is Tanaka-san Dave.
And we look forward to talking to you again next week. Goodbye.
See you then.